Sandpoint KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
ChatGPT Plus is free for college students through May. Here's the thing. You've got a lot to do between now and then. Studying for finals, writing papers, trying to keep your life on track. And ChatGPT can help with all of it. It can quiz you for your econ exam, make a study guide from your French notes, plan out your meals and study breaks. It can get really specific on how you like to learn. It can even help you come up with ways to stop procrastinating. So from now until summer break, take advantage of all the ways ChatGPT can make your life easier. Restrictions apply.
Whatever the occasion, effortless elegance is right this way. Because Hilton brings you new ways to stay, courtesy of the Nomad London. And it doesn't stop at award-winning dining in a space draped in velvet and illuminated by vintage chandeliers. No, this day goes beyond with unparalleled personalized service and attentive hospitality. Oh, and did we mention the Nomad London can be booked using your Hilton Honors points at Hilton.com? Hilton, for the stay.
Hi, it's Molly. 2025 is the year of big change in science funding as federal spending is slashed for public agencies. Both science and science journalism are under siege. But you can help by supporting this independent journalism endeavor. By donating to Big Picture Science, you help us continue to bring you important science research within its context. This episode you're about to hear is an example of the kind of original reporting that your support allows us to do. If you've already joined us at Patreon, thank you. If you haven't, it's easy to do. Just go to patreon.com/bigpicturescience. It doesn't cost much. For as little as $2 a month, you get early access to ad-free versions of each episode. If you support independent science journalism and Big Picture Science in particular, you can let us know in a way that makes a big difference. Please join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. And thank you. In late August 2005, meteorologists in Louisiana were closely tracking a tropical storm in the Bahamas.
A monster Category 3 storm and possibly taking aim at southeast Louisiana. Hurricane Katrina continues to move west in the Gulf of Mexico.
Scientists at the National Weather Service in Maryland and at the National Hurricane Center in Florida watched the storm first with interest and then with dread, as Katrina grew into a Category 3 hurricane and then rapidly intensified into a Category 5 as it barreled toward the Gulf Coast.
And let's take you to New Orleans now, where the press conference is underway with Mayor Ray Nagin. We'll get the updated information on his city's preparedness for Hurricane Katrina.
The storm is intensifying and is still pointed toward New Orleans, and it's not a meteorologist or an expert that I have talked to that says that this storm will not impact New Orleans in a major way.
As a result, Hurricane Katrina was back to a Category 3 when it made landfall in southern Louisiana with wind speeds of 125 miles per hour. In New Orleans, it dropped up to 10 inches of rain and caused widespread flooding. And that was before the levees broke.
The governor of Louisiana said today that she is considering the remarkable step of evacuating the remaining residents of New Orleans after waters from Lake Pontchartrain broke through a levee. And with much of New Orleans now underwater, authorities are focused on search and rescue.
Katrina caused hundreds of billions of dollars in damage and remains the costliest hurricane in history. More than a million residents of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana were forced to flee their homes for parts unknown. Hundreds of thousands never returned. More than 1,300 people were killed. The magnitude of the catastrophe was a brutal wake-up to our vulnerability to natural disasters, to hurricanes in particular. It created the era before Katrina and the one after, and a new benchmark for what can go wrong. The devastating storm shone a harsh light on levee engineering failures, the vulnerability of our infrastructure, flaws in government disaster response, and the socioeconomic disparities in disaster preparedness and response. Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley. As we enter another hurricane season 20 years after Katrina, we thought that if there was any consolation to be had by the catastrophe, it was that it jolted us awake to the cost in human lives, in human suffering, and in structural damage of not being prepared for a new climate reality. But is that what happened? In the years since Katrina, our tools for forecasting hurricanes have improved. We've learned more about how climate change is affecting hurricanes. But can our preparedness keep pace with storms dumping more rain, creating more flooding, and producing greater storm surges? This year, we enter hurricane season with one more question. How will proposed budget and job cuts of unprecedented size to the federal agencies tasked with studying and forecasting hurricanes affect our ability to prepare for and recover from them? We explore these questions in a series of episodes marking the 20th anniversary of Katrina. This first episode is called Hurricane Season. In the spring, during a month outside of hurricane season, the National Hurricane Conference becomes a focus of education and professional training for disaster preparedness. It is the calm eye that allows scientists, community organizers, and emergency managers to share new information about forecasting, preparedness, and recovery, and, as always, what Plan B looks like when Plan A fails. I attended this year's conference in New Orleans, where attendees reflected on what we've learned 20 years since Katrina. I met determined and heroic people devoted to keeping communities safe, including those who stay put during hurricanes when others are forced to leave, and you'll hear from some of them in this series. While Katrina was a defining event for the Gulf Coast and for our country, it was not the last of the devastating hurricanes. As Sandy, Harvey, Irma, Maria, and Helene have shown us, Katrina was more like the beginning. Since then, climate change has slowly stretched either end of the conventional June to October hurricane season like a rubber band. It now starts earlier and lasts longer. And despite the critical lesson delivered by Katrina, that we must be prepared for a natural disaster on an unimaginable scale, this hurricane season begins with an administration proposing that we dismantle the federal agencies that help us prepare. We shift our attention now from the Gulf Coast to another part of the country that experienced its own Katrina-like wake-up call a few years ago.
My name is Yvette Henry. I work with the Department of Human Services in the U.S. Virgin Islands, specifically on St. Thomas. I am the mass care lead for disaster preparedness for our department.
The Virgin Islands are no strangers to hurricanes, even big hurricanes. Being prepared for storms is as much a part of Caribbean culture as warm breezes and beautiful sunsets. But Yvette Henry said that everything changed in 2017 when two Category 5 hurricanes, Irma and Maria, hit the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico just 2 weeks apart.
In 1989, we had Hugo that came through the Virgin Islands. Then we thought that it was devastating, you know, as a territory. Then in 1995, we had Hurricane Marilyn. She really did a wallop. When we thought that Hugo, you know, damaged and devastated the islands, Marilyn did a number to us. But we saw a very horrific view in 2017, having two Category 5s 2 weeks apart, not knowing, you know, haven't ever gone through anything like Irma and Maria at those intensifications.
I was struck that you said in your remarks that really nothing had happened like these twin hurricanes
and
before.
That is so true. Nothing of that capacity has happened to the territory, to the Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, St. John, Water Island, and St. Croix. Nothing to that magnitude.
My name is Abigail Hendricks, and I am in charge of ESF-6 on the island of St. John, Virgin Islands. ESF-6 means Emergency Support Function 6.
I'm Megan Enright. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called Love City Strong on the island of St. John, and we work in disaster preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation. At the time, it felt like an anomaly. It felt like an amount of devastation that people just couldn't imagine, especially two Category 5 hurricanes in 2 weeks. It just felt unheard of. And I think now what we can say, looking back from the last 8 years, is that it doesn't feel like an anomaly anymore. Now it just feels like a regular hurricane season. And so in that sense, I do feel like 2017 felt like a turning point.
Hurricane Irma is smashing tiny islands in the eastern Caribbean with 185 mile per hour winds. The Category 5 storm made its first landfall overnight on the island of Barbuda. A government message from nearby Antigua ended with the words, "May God protect us all."
When Irma was making her way towards the U.S. Virgin Islands, the storm registered on seismographs, right? Like, it was physically shaking the seafloor and the islands. And we're used to storms taking all the leaves off of trees, but the bark was off of trees. It looked like a bomb had gone off.
I thought the apocalypse had come. I thought this was truly the end of the world. I was in my house on the top floor, and I literally watched my roof peel back like a sardine can. I kid you not.
It was like Hurricane 2.0. Like, she was angry. You know, the intensification of it all was quite overwhelming for Irma, because that was like definitely off the chart. We almost got sucked out of a building. It was that horrific. And, you know, then we're done. And 2 weeks later to the date, here comes Maria.
As Maria made landfall, you could see the powerful impacts on the islands of Guadeloupe, which sits just north of Dominica.
Hurricane Maria was the second deadliest U.S. storm after the Galveston, Texas hurricane in 1900. Maria killed more than 3,000 people, the majority residents of Puerto Rico. Power was not restored to that island for 11 months, making it the longest blackout in U.S. history. Abigail, Megan, and Yvette reflected on the effects of the 1-2 punch of having two Category 5 hurricanes, defined by 155-mile-an-hour winds, hit the islands of St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix within 2 weeks.
It was a knockout, first of all. Irma was definitely off the Richter scale. I think that they need to revisit the way they categorize them, because to say that Irma was a Cat 5 is a great understatement. It made landfall at 235 mile per hour winds.
And then the other thing I would say from a direct impact perspective is Irma was a very intense wind event. Maria was a rain event. So again, still a Category 5 on the wind scale, but not as intense winds as Irma, but much, much more rain. I think I remember them saying we got almost 30 inches of rain in 24 hours.
We lived through tornadoes in those hurricanes. We lived through the highs and lows when the ice passed over the islands, how hot it was, and the dead eerie sound of just having that lapse of time going through the eye. It was crazy. It was the longest day on earth for us.
It sounds terrifying.
It is terrifying, and I wouldn't wish it with anybody else, but I don't know if I want to live anywhere else in the world, because the Virgin Islands, until you've visited us, it is truly an awesome place. You get up every day to know that you're living a beautiful summer day every day of the year.
I hope I make it someday.
Yeah, I hope so.
Weather forecasts can provide the most valuable asset for preparedness, time. Early warnings by the National Hurricane Center as Katrina approached provide sufficient time for many people to evacuate. As part of the U.S., the territories also depend on the National Weather Service and NOAA forecasts. Early warning is crucial on an island where there are few options for leaving.
Okay, so there's a West Indian term called tumbao. We can say we got tumbaoed by Maria. Simply because we had no idea that it was coming, because we didn't have any communications. Because at 11 o'clock during Irma, we lost our communication tower. So that was it.
After Irma had passed, St. John was without phones, landlines, cell service, internet, anything. Irma also damaged the radar infrastructure in the Caribbean. So there was no radar in the region. And I remember the day that it was was when we found out that Maria was coming and that it was likely to be a category 4 or 5.
How did you find out?
So every morning after Irma, the team from FEMA that eventually arrived and the Coast Guard team that was working, they would have a meeting in town. And St. John's a very small place. And so once word was out that like the people who were in charge were having a meeting, people just started showing up. And so every day at 7 o'clock, people would come down to the dock and there would be a public meeting and we would get briefed by the Coast Guard and FEMA and like this very high level like technical briefing. And they would give us the weather because we didn't have any way to get a weather report. We're very self-sufficient in many ways. We're very resilient. I think what we realized after 2017 is that we did not have the skills that this type of an impact and this type of a recovery required. And I think that we also had gotten a little comfortable because, you know, we had had several storms between 1995 when Maryland came through and 2017, but none of them were major. None of them were above a category 3. And people had gotten comfortable that we weren't going to get hit. And so people were off island for the month of September, hadn't even boarded up their homes, and, you know, lost everything. So I think the resilience conversation and the self-sufficiency conversation intensified in that we had to rehome those skills and cultivate those skills so that the next time we would be able to do more of the work ourselves.
I think self-sufficiency in itself grew to involving more community. So I appreciate the community coming out and wanting to help. We had FEMA, we had so many people come on the ground to try and assist as soon as they could have, because of course ports were closed, we had sunken ships, but we know now, a lot of the boaters know now, when that warning comes out, don't wait, just try and prepare and move to drier and better grounds.
I think I heard the phrase, be prepared, about 20 times this morning. Be prepared. That's what it comes down to.
Yes, and preparation is ongoing. It's a 365 plus two, I would say, and 2 days extra we need.
What is your relationship to the mainland or stateside in terms of disaster or emergency help? Because first of all, you are islands, but also those policies are changing now so that those emergency services and some of that weather tracking, hurricane tracking data may, if they don't go away, they may be curtailed. What does that mean when we think about what it means to be self-sufficient on these hurricane-prone islands?
First of all, one of the challenges right now is that nobody really knows what's being cut. There's a lot of different assessments of what is happening and what it's going to mean and how long it's going to last. And I think as we head into this year's hurricane season, there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think that is very challenging for folks who sit in the path, potential paths of hurricanes, because we just don't know what to expect. We have said since 2017 that disasters are getting too big and too expansive in their scope and their impact for any one sector to handle them alone. It's too much for FEMA. It's too much for state and local governments. It's too much for the nonprofit sector. The only way for response and recovery to work is for everyone to contribute whatever they can.
And then because we're a tourist destination and St. John has a huge tourist presence, the mainland means to us help, because you could literally feel the love coming from the stage. We knew that people were thinking about us. And as soon as donations were able to come in, they came 100%. So the mainland to us also means like help is coming, because at least now people know that we're there. We're not just a dot in the middle of the ocean just floating around.
Megan, you did say at this conference that the islands, although they are connected to the U.S. and there's a lot of attachment there, and you did get some support from the United States, you are in some ways isolated. And you said that you're also, quite frankly, overlooked. And what did you mean by that?
I was remembering sitting at my house waiting for Irma to make landfall, and we were watching the national news, and they were doing a weather segment about the hurricane, and they were talking about how Irma could make her first potential U.S. landfall in 4 days. And we were within like 12 hours of a landfall. It can be easy for people to just forget that we're a part of the country because we feel a little foreign.
What does it mean for you going forward when you think about the hurricanes that are yet to come? Are these, the 2017 hurricanes, something you think about in the rearview mirror that happened and may not happen again?
Oh, we cannot say that. I think for a long time, you know, 2017, Irma Maria would be a part of our lives. And we know now from climate change that the water surfaces are getting hotter and things are intensifying even faster than before. So we can't ever let our guards down. We can't ever say that this won't happen again. It can happen again and may even happen, you know, stronger. So we just have to be prepared.
If you could give a big picture perspective of what this hurricane preparedness and this change in the intensity of hurricanes means for people elsewhere around the world, because some people could say, okay, those are hurricanes, those are in the Gulf Coast, those are in the Virgin Islands, it's a tragedy, but it's a really isolated event. How do you help everyone else perhaps relate to what you all are experiencing?
Well, the proof is in the pudding, because nowadays hurricanes are touching New York, touching Georgia, you know, they're coming inland. So it's not just an isolated thing for the islands. They're coming. They're getting to be more and more frequently coming.
Our experience is so relevant to certainly small rural communities everywhere, because we're a physical island, but small rural communities are resource islands, and they deal with a lot of the same logistical challenges that we do. And anyone who knows me knows that this is my favorite topic, and I will talk about it until I'm blue in the face. But my mom, particularly recently, she lives in Asheville, and she experienced Hurricane Helene, and thankfully, she was safe and she didn't lose her home. But she called me afterwards and she said, you know, I've heard what you've said and I understood what you were saying, but I didn't quite expect it to come home to roost quite so quickly. And I think her perspective was, I live in Asheville. We're essentially a climate haven. You know, we don't have to worry about these things. And what we're learning is that everyone has to worry about these things. And more communities are going to experience catastrophic first of their kind events over the next decade. I think any community that's gone through something like this feels a real kinship towards other communities that have experienced it. And I think the goal is to make sure that people can understand that before it happens to them so they can be more prepared.
Later in the show, a former NOAA official tells us about the dangers of cutting back on our 24/7 weather forecasts and alert systems if proposed budget cuts to the agency go through. But first, the head of the National Hurricane Center describes our improved ability to forecast storms since Katrina and how climate change is reshaping them.
So I think the focus has been too much on the intensity change of the storm, which is only a very small piece of the puzzle that results in the hazards, and it really needs to be more focused on the water hazards, the storm surge and the flooding, which are responsible for the vast majority of fatalities in tropical storms and hurricanes.
This episode of Big Picture Science, the first in a series tied to the 20th anniversary of Katrina, is called Hurricane Season.
So, you just started using LinkedIn Premium. Now what? Well, on your premium company page, you noticed around 7.5 times more page engagement and 5 times more page views. Well done. And now, new clients are messaging you. All because you're using LinkedIn Premium, which helps you get the business growth you want. Think big, small business. Think big. Start your free trial at linkedin.com/premiumsmallbusiness. That's linkedin.com/premiumsmallbusiness.
We've been hearing about how devastating hurricanes can be and how important it is to track them and prepare for their arrival. This is a time for us to increase our efforts to understand hurricanes to minimize their damage as much as possible. Big Picture Science is committed to bringing on-the-ground reporting about this and other critical science topics every week. But good journalism isn't free to produce. Your donations can go a long way in supporting our original reporting. You can join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience to get started, and no amount is too small. Our members enjoy early access to ad-free versions of each episode and access to exclusive bonus material. It's easy to pitch in, and we hope that you do so by joining us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. And thank you. For 40 years, the nonprofit National Hurricane Conference has drawn scientists and educators for discussions about disaster preparedness and response. At this year's conference in New Orleans, though, representatives of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, including its scientists who helped organize the conference, weren't there. I asked the conference media coordinator why.
My name is Rebecca Mueller. I am the media room director for the National Hurricane Conference. What's different this year, the first time in history of the conference, is that NOAA and the National Hurricane Center folks are not here due to travel restrictions.
And do you know more than that, why they have travel restrictions?
No, unfortunately, I'm not aware as to the why of the travel restrictions.
And can you remind us why they might want to attend the National Hurricane Conference? This is members of NOAA and the National Hurricane Center. Why would they want to be here, and why have they been here for years?
They've been an integral part of planning this conference. The director and many of the scientists at the National Hurricane Center lead in the general session. They organize several of the workshops. They facilitate the panels. They're the ones developing new technology to continue to improve the forecast process for hurricanes. And it's important for them to be here so that emergency managers and other individuals in the industry get to hear straight from them, and that the media, such as yourself, get to hear straight from them. So we're definitely missing their presence this year.
One scientist unable to attend was the director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida, Michael Brennan. The NHC is part of the National Weather Service, which is a division of NOAA. We did speak with him, though, because NOAA made Dr. Brennan available to reporters for brief interviews over Zoom. Dr. Brennan explained how in the 2 decades since Katrina, we have more evidence for how climate change is affecting hurricanes, and at the same time, our tools have improved for monitoring and forecasting them. Michael, have hurricanes changed in their intensity or frequency since Katrina?
Not so much in frequency. I mean, hurricanes are a very cyclical thing in terms of overall activity in the basin and in terms of how much of that activity ends up making landfall in a particular area. We have had a very busy period of hurricane activity in the United States. Since 2017, we've had 25 U.S. hurricane landfalls. But in the period from 2005 to 2017, we didn't have any major hurricane landfalls in the United States for about 12 years. So it was pretty quiet after the 05 season for all the way up through the mid-20-teens, and it's been very busy since then. One thing we have seen that's a little different is rapid intensification is a little more rapid and a little more frequent than it used to be. Maybe 10 to 20 years ago, perhaps due to warmer ocean conditions. But again, that's a small change that we've seen so far in terms of just overall storm behavior.
Mm-hmm. And could you give us just a description of what rapid intensification means?
Sure. We define rapid intensification as a change in the intensity of a tropical storm or hurricane by at least 35 miles per hour in 24 hours. So a one-day increase of strength of a storm by about 35 miles per hour or more. So Katrina was a storm that certainly went through a period of rapid intensification over the Gulf before it made landfall. We saw rapid intensification occur in both Helene and Milton last season before those storms made landfall. So rapid intensification tends to occur early in a storm's life cycle. So those storms that develop near the United States, near in the Caribbean or the Gulf or near Florida, are particularly dangerous because they are in that early life cycle and tend to be when storms do rapidly intensify, and then those systems can make landfall very quickly.
In a minute, I'll ask you what the challenges are for forecasting such storms, but being here at this conference, I'm struck by the number of people, for example, from the Virgin Islands, and maybe those who went through Katrina, who feel like they're in a new normal, that these hurricanes have become more intense, that they are witnessing more destruction than they had in the past. And it feels like we are in a new reality of more intense storms, if not more frequent storms.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have had a lot of intense storms in the last few years. But again, that's, again, this cyclical period where we had many years without a lot of major hurricanes, you know, from the late 20-aughts up into the 20-teens. But we've certainly had a lot of activity in the western part of the basin in the last few years, which has brought a lot of impacts to land areas. You can think of Maria affecting, you know, Puerto Rico in 2017. Also, Irma affected the Virgin Islands. So we have had a very intense period of landfalling and land impacting hurricanes across the rest of the basin, or the western part of the basin, since 2017. But there are other periods of very frequent intense hurricane activity if you go back into earlier portions of the 20th century. So while it's not unprecedented, it is somewhat something that many people have not experienced in their lifetimes who are in this part of the basin right now.
Do we have evidence that climate change is making hurricanes more intense, just so we're clear on that?
There's some indications that storms are getting a little bit stronger, but it's in the low numbers of single digits of percent change. So it's something that's almost within our uncertainty of how strong storms actually are. What we are more confident of is that in a warming climate, the impacts of storms are worsening in terms of sea level rise is making storm surge worse than it would have been 20 years ago. And that sea level rise likely will continue to increase the risk of storm surge. In addition to that, we are seeing heavier rainfall from tropical storms and hurricanes, but also from other weather events that are worsening freshwater flooding problems. So I think the focus has been too much on the intensity change of the storm, which is only a very small piece of the puzzle that results in the hazards. And it really needs to be more focused on the water hazards, the storm surge and the flooding, which are responsible for the vast majority of fatalities in tropical storms and hurricanes.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, what are the biggest forecasting challenges as hurricanes exhibit that rapid intensification? Does that present particular challenges?
Yes, definitely. Rapid intensification has long been a very specific forecast challenge we faced in the realm of tropical storms and hurricanes. The good news is that we're actually now starting to forecast it. Before 5-10 years ago, we never would have made explicit forecasts of rapid intensification. So at the time of Katrina, back to 2005, we didn't really have the tools at our disposal to try to make these aggressive intensity forecasts. We were basically responding to what we saw happening with the storm at the time in terms of satellite imagery and in terms of aircraft observations. And we were just adjusting the forecast as the storm was actually already strengthening. In recent years, we've cut our forecast errors in about half for situations of rapid intensification. So for storms like Helene and Milton, we're now actually forecasting rapid intensification. So forecasting it is part of the solution, but then the other challenge is the messaging of it and getting people to understand that even if we are expecting a storm to rapidly intensify, they may need to take action for a system that isn't even a tropical storm yet, but we're expecting it to be a major hurricane in 3 days affecting them, and they may need to start evacuating or may need to take other life safety preparedness. And I think a lot of people respond to what they see the storm looks like at the time. So if you think about like a Hurricane Irma in 2017 that we watched come all the way across the Atlantic, it was a Category 5 hurricane in the Caribbean, devastated portions of the Lesser Antilles. People in Florida saw Irma coming, and the response in terms of preparedness and evacuation was some of the highest rates we've ever seen. Now, you contrast that to a storm that's going to develop and not look like much now. You don't have any visual evidence of its impacts, but it's going to affect you within 2 or 3 days, and you need to take action on something that's not even really there yet. That's a more challenging messaging problem that we in the meteorological community face, but not just us, but it extends into the emergency management community and just the broader hurricane enterprise to get people to take action on a system that is going to change very quickly within a couple of days.
If we look at the lessons learned from Katrina, What would happen if Katrina hit today? I wonder what would be improved and what we'd still need to work on with regard to hurricane prediction. I know there are many, many countless variables when we talk about if Katrina hit today, would it be any different?
Yeah.
But when we talk about the advance notice or the ways in which the National Hurricane Center could play a role, how would it be different today?
Yeah, I think in terms of the meteorological part of the forecast, I think the forecast would be more accurate today than it was at the time. The forecast for Katrina at the time were quite good, especially in terms of track. The intensity forecasts were pretty typical for that time. As I mentioned before, we didn't have much of an ability to forecast or anticipate these rapid intensity changes. I think now if we had a Katrina event, we would be better able to forecast that rapid strengthening that we saw occur with the storm over the Gulf. We wouldn't probably get it exactly right, but we would at least have some idea that it would happen. And we'd probably have a better idea of anticipating the structural changes that we would see in the storm as it approached landfall, as it went through that eyewall cycle and the storm, the peak winds came down, but the storm got much bigger. And that had dramatic impacts on the storm surge footprint, for example. The other thing that's really different now is we actually have a warning specifically for storm surge inundation. And that was introduced in 2017. At the time of Katrina, the storm surge information we could provide here from the Hurricane Center was very, very rudimentary. It was basically a number. This was how much storm surge was expected above normal tide levels within this very broad area along the coast. We had no way to visualize that the inland penetration or the extent of the storm surge threat, or to tell people what degree of storm surge inundation they needed to plan for. Now we have graphics that show a reasonable worst case scenario for storm surge inundation at a given location. So we'd be able to provide a lot more detailed information to the public, to the media, but also to emergency managers and other decision makers who are having to decide where to call for evacuations. We can provide that information now 2 to sometimes 3 days in advance, giving more lead time to people. So, the meteorological information we can provide would be a lot better. I would hope that the outcomes from that particular event would be improved as well. We have a lot of different ways to reach people now, beyond just say broadcast television. We can reach people through wireless emergency alerts on their cell phone. People have a lot more different ways to stay connected and consume information now about a storm.
And Michael, where were you during Katrina?
I was actually in graduate school still, so I was not here at the Hurricane Center in 2005. So I was watching it unfold from North Carolina, where I went to grad school, and seeing that happen here. But we still have quite a few staff here at NHC who did work and were around for Katrina 20 years ago.
Well, then finally, what are the big scientific frontiers in hurricane prediction? And what is the role of government research scientists in advancing those frontiers, either at the National Hurricane Center or your parent organization, NOAA?
Yeah, research is really important. It's a multi-year pipeline to take new technology, try out new observation tools like drones, or develop new forecast models, then test them, evaluate them, iterate on that process, and then get them to the point where they're sort of operationally ready for prime time for us to use in actually making forecasts and issuing watches and warnings here at the Hurricane Center. So that whole pipeline is really vital and has paid dividends in the forecast improvements we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years, especially through the things like the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project that was really developed in the aftermath of the 2004 and 2005 hurricane season. So that's really vital to ensuring that we continue to move ahead.
Okay. Michael Brennan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Michael Brennan is the director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. As he said, we have improved tools to forecast things like rapid intensification of hurricanes and storm surges. How could funding cuts to agencies such as NOAA and the National Weather Service impact our ability to use them?
There were some proposed cuts back in the first Trump administration, but not to the level that this year's is. This year's would actually defund significant offices within, which would essentially then lead to their closing or consolidating it.
That's next. This episode of Big Picture Science, the first in a series tied to the 20th anniversary of Katrina, is called Hurricane Season.
Yeah.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Even though the big lesson from Hurricane Katrina 20 years ago was to be prepared even for the unimaginable, we enter this hurricane season with the administration proposing significant cuts to the agencies that provide our warning and response systems. We've talked in previous episodes about what might happen when researchers from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, are prevented from collecting, analyzing, or releasing data. Not being able to do so may have a direct bearing on our preparedness for hurricanes. The proposed cuts would affect NOAA and the division under it, the National Weather Service, which includes the National Hurricane Center. Of course, the data that NOAA collects helps us forecast not only hurricanes, but other severe weather events, including tornadoes, like the deadly ones that recently swept through Missouri, Kentucky, and Virginia. The agency also provides us with crucial climate information.
Hi, I'm Julie Roberts, and I am the former Director of Communications and Deputy Chief of Staff for NOAA under the Trump administration.
In a conversation with producer Shannon Geary, Julie Roberts, who held her position at NOAA under the first Trump administration, helps us put the size of the current proposed cuts in perspective and how they might affect our data collecting ability and disaster response.
So this year's proposed budget for FY26 is a significant cut from the FY25 budget. It's about $1.7 billion less. And so that's going to be a significant cut to the operating fund for NOAA.
And in all of NOAA's history, have we ever seen proposed cuts this large before?
Not that I am aware of. Going back to really the Bush days were kind of probably my first time of really knowing and understanding the NOAA and kind of the budgets. I have not seen these type of budget cuts. There were some proposed cuts back in the first Trump administration, but not to the level that this year's is. This year's would actually defund significant offices within, which would essentially then lead to their closing or consolidating it.
And when we're talking about like such large sums of money, I think that is a little bit difficult to picture. So maybe we can put it into a more tangible effect. You know, how exactly are these cuts going to impact NOAA's ability to do its job?
So one of the big things I found of interest is that this significant cut is about 74% of a cut to the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab. And your listeners are saying, okay, what the heck is that? Well, that's actually a really important lab. That is the one that builds the models that go into the hurricane forecasting models. That model was actually delivered to the National Hurricane Center in May in order to be able to forecast the upcoming hurricane season. So you're talking about a significant cut to one of the offices alone that plays a big role in our disaster and our weather forecasting. I mean, that's just one example of those kind of cuts and what it can look like for hurricane season. Just a little background. I have a background in disaster management. I came from Florida Emergency Management before NOAA. And like that is something that is key for states to be able to prepare for hurricane season, especially after the catastrophic event of 2024. There's also this other little thing after hurricanes that I really find amazing. And it was that I still refer to us as we, even though I haven't been there for 5 years, but it's, they go out and take aerial footage of the area that's been impacted by a hurricane. And one of them, it was Irma. And the only way we could see the Florida Keys was because of that. So that then allowed people to know whether their home was still standing. And so that's just like, NOAA has an everyday impact on our lives, and most people have no idea what that could look like.
And it's interesting, sometimes when we talk about like the loss of data collection, it's something that you may not feel for a couple of years. Let's say if you're monitoring like climate change in a specific area, but monitoring things like hurricanes, I can imagine the loss of that data has an immediate impact because you're trying to predict storms that are happening in the next week or in the next day.
Well, and you know, there are also things that we don't really necessarily think about from those impacts to industries like shipping, right? So, you know, we may have to close the Gulf down because there's a storm brewing and you can't come back in, or maybe it's the construction, right? So now the construction industry is using the NOAA data to make a decision about where they can build a house or where they need to pause that. Even now into the financial market, some of the major financial companies use this data in order to make decisions about risk and also being able to decide, you know, where are the potential impacts going forward before they invest in certain areas of the country.
And now, one data set that I know NOAA plays a key role in is creating or helping to create the National Climate Assessment. And that's a report that is published every 4 years or so and evaluates the impact of climate change on the country as a whole. And just this week that we're talking, about 400 scientists who were working on the report were dismissed. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how that dismissal will impact the NCA and exactly how is the National Climate Assessment used currently?
So interesting that you ask. The last one that came out was 2018 when I was the NOAA Director of Communications, and I worked with our staff in order to be able to get that report published. You know, there was resistance. I was working for an administration that resisted that. But I thought it was really important for that report to come out and talk about what are the impacts looking forward. You know, I can't tell you exactly what all the impacts may be of it not coming out this time. I do think that what's going to happen is there's going to be a lag of information going forward. You know, you could assume, if depending on who's in the White House next, might reinstate that report. But then there's a lag of that research and being able to show it. As I mentioned, you know, I have a background in disaster management, and I've had people ask, well, climate change, you can't believe in it. And I always say, well, as a disaster manager, I have to believe in it. We can debate what causes it, but I have to be able to mitigate future disasters. And so those kind of reports and being able to publish that is really helpful for decision makers, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
So it has both, you know, local and global impacts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the United States is a world leader, and we are respected around the world to be able to provide information and to be able to talk to what's going on. And so when you're not having that information out there, someone's going to fill the void, maybe, but we don't know. And so I think the lasting impacts of those kind of things are not going to be seen right away, but over the next 2, 5, 10, 20 years, as we look at what the future may look like from a disaster perspective.
And when reading about the proposed cuts to NOAA, the news coverage of them, one quote that I found really powerful came from an anonymous worker who spoke to The Guardian, and they said that these cuts would put NOAA on a non-science trajectory. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. You know, what would it mean for NOAA's kind of scientific agenda to be cut or dismantled?
It's going to have lasting impacts. You know, the thing is that it's the science agenda that we all get hung up on the climate piece of that, right? But there's so much more to that. The fisheries, the, you know, I was kind of going through and thinking through, like, oh my gosh, all this data, what does that look like? What are these impacts going to be if NOAA's no longer their expert? And people don't realize things like farmers. I mean, if you were to ask your listeners, they probably have no idea that our agricultural industry is utilizing these NOAA models and these NOAA tools to make decisions about when to plant crops. The corn growers each year can save as much as $4 billion in fertilizer and the cleanup simply because of the models and the information from NOAA, from the National Weather Service. And so it's very short-sighted to say, we don't need those scientists, we don't need that information, we don't need that modeling. There are direct impacts into our economy because of these decisions that are currently being made. I think, again, it's just being able to understand and be able to highlight a lot of the work that NOAA does outside of the National Weather Service or hurricanes. You know, those are the things, if you ask, oh, okay. I used to tell people I had the best job in the administration because I got to work on everything from the floor of the ocean to the surface of the sun and everything in between. And it was just this, like, and in 2018, I asked to be exempted for the shutdown because I knew we had to be able to talk about what the work we were doing. So I then became the one comms person for the entire agency, and I learned so much. And so I just want to be able to talk about what does that look like and help people understand this is a significant impact that is going to happen to our country because of these types of cuts.
And for data sets or long-term studies that are still going to be undergoing, maybe despite the proposed budget cuts, what happens to that data? Is it, as you said, where perhaps we will just see kind of a lag in information? Will the data being collected just have to be less robust because of a strain on resources?
I think that some of the modeling, some of the Ocean Service observations that are out there, the tools, you know, there will be cuts to those kind of things. And so that data will not be collected. I'd like to think that maybe some of the cooperative partners out there may still be able to do this data collection, continue to write these reports. But if they have funding that is tied into the grant side of NOAA through one of the offices, that funding is potentially going to be cut.
I know this might be difficult to answer, but, you know, do you have any insights into what this administration's reasoning for these large scale cuts to or proposed cuts to NOAA could be? You know, why now and why are they doing this?
So this actually started in the first administration. During the first term, there was significant cuts that were being proposed to staff and also wanting to privatize the National Weather Service. So it doesn't surprise me. Unfortunately, I think they pretty much outlined it in some of the Project 2025 data that was out there. You know, I'm not so certain if it's about saving money, if there is some of it is privatizing components. I always say National Weather Service privatizing it. Okay, fine. But then that means the average person doesn't necessarily get their data, that doesn't get their forecast. I had a conversation today with somebody who was like, oh, but what about our local station? And I said, well, where do you think your local station gets their resources to do a forecast? These are NOAA resources. This is stuff that is provided to the public for free, but as a service. And, you know, if we start to privatize any of these aspects of it, there's going to be impacts of it. And, you know, I'm not certain why, other than they want to privatize components of it. You know, somewhere along the way, we've made climate change a very political topic, and it shouldn't be.
And if we can go big picture here at the end, I'm wondering, you know, how do you think the public overall will be impacted by the loss of this scientific research and what sounds like just the accessibility to this scientific research that NOAA does?
So I also have a trade association I started a couple years ago that focuses on business industry and the disaster management world. We help business helping business get back to business, right? And we've been talking about the data sets, the information that's out there that businesses will use to make decisions, whether it's a NOAA data set or resources on the FEMA side. Both of them are seeing cuts that are going to impact our communities, whether it's a tornado outbreak or a hurricane or an earthquake, you know, and so it's going to have an impact. I've really wanted to question why we think we need to pull so much information off of existing websites. It's already been paid for. It's out there. Other than paying maybe some hosting fees, why are we removing that? But we are trying to identify from our association standpoint, where do we get some of this information now that may go away tomorrow? And how do we go backfill that? And I have told our members, hey, if you're used to going to XYZ NOAA website and it's no longer there, make a note so we can help find where that data set may come from in the future. But right now, a lot of it's up in the air. I had the chance to travel around and meet our team around the country, and it was the most amazing group of people to work with that were so dedicated to the science they were working on and to making our country a better place and our world a better place. And so just seeing them under attack, I just feel like it's time to stand up and speak out on what's going to happen.
And Julie, was there anything else you wanted to say in regard to these proposed budget cuts to NOAA and how you feel it will impact the American public?
I just, you know, I think the biggest thing is that there is going to be a financial impact, whether it's communities that lose their homes due to wildfires or hurricanes or tornadoes, to potential loss of life, of somebody not receiving the alert that is needed. There are going to be, you know, cuts now to the National Weather Service where 30 out of the 122 Weather Service offices are missing their chief meteorologist. And that includes things like Houston and Cleveland and New York City. I mean, big, big offices that have a lot of responsibility. Other ones are talking about having to stop doing 24/7 operation. I always tell people disasters do not look at a clock. They don't watch 8 to 5. And so what happens if these offices have now been so constrained they can no longer run a 24/7 operation? You know, there's a lot of headlines right now about the air traffic control and what's going on, especially up in the Northeast. And when you think about it, two of the most stressful jobs that are out there in the federal government are air traffic controllers and National Weather Service when there is a catastrophic tornado outbreak like we have seen in previous years. And so I think that's where people are not really thinking about what this means, not just from budget cuts, but also staffing cuts. We've seen significant staffing cuts across the Weather Service that are going to also have an impact. So last month was the National Hurricane Conference in New Orleans, and I have been attending that conference for over 10 years. This is the first year that federal employees were not allowed to attend. That meant we did not have representatives from NOAA, the National Weather Service, National Hurricane Center, from FEMA, from other national federal partners. And there was a real lapse of that knowledge. It was the, ironically, it was the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and we were talking about it. And this atmosphere really, I felt like, took us back to almost before Katrina, and that attitude of not really being prepared. And so it was just a real big, you know, hole in the programming, and just unfortunate to not have representatives of those departments and agencies that are going to play a significant role in the hurricane season as we look forward to June.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for helping us understand the context of these proposed budget cuts to NOAA, and for helping us understand just how many aspects of NOAA kind of feed into our everyday lives.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Julie Roberts is a former director of communications and deputy chief of staff for NOAA under the first Trump administration. In the second episode of our series on the 20th anniversary of Katrina, we hear how old-school technology was used to provide crucial information during the storm and why it still has a part to play today.
We were the first to hear from a ham radio operator that was volunteering at the Superdome. And he communicated with us and told us that part of the roof was flying off the Superdome. Nobody had heard about that before.
This show is thanks to astronomer and producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. And a big thanks to Yvette Henry, Abigail Hendricks, and Megan Enright, who shared their perspectives with us from the National Hurricane Conference in New Orleans. I'm Molly Bentley, the executive producer for Big Picture Science. We'd like to give a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, that considers what we've learned about hurricanes and our state of readiness since Katrina, is called Hurricane Season.
Are you thinking of getting an in-demand degree that will set you apart in the Seattle job market? At WGU, you can earn a supply chain and operations bachelor's degree online and around your current schedule. Designed with input from industry experts, you'll learn at the speed of business and be prepared to work for a vast range of employers, helping an organization make smarter, quicker, and more efficient decisions. Discover how you can earn the skills needed to make an immediate impact at wgu.edu/Seattle.
From the creators of the popular science show with millions of YouTube subscribers comes the Minute Earth podcast. Every episode of the show dives deep into a science question you might not even know you had. But once you hear the answer, you'll want to share it with everyone you know. Why do rivers curve? Why did the T-Rex have such tiny arms? And why do so many more kids need glasses now than they used to? Spoiler alert, it isn't screen time. Our team of scientists digs into the research and breaks it down into a short, entertaining explanation, jam-packed with science facts and terrible puns. Subscribe to Minute Earth wherever you like to listen.
What's the frequency? Can it this year? Been so drained.